Hey, everybody, and welcome back to our podcast on statistics for the social sciences. Jenny here, glad to be joining you again. And today we are going to launch into a conversation of correlation, or really the way I describe this is how two variables move together. So a lot of my analogies in this set of slides is dancing, which is pretty easy. A nice way to visualize, let's say, correlation, because we can generally see dancers either moving together or not so much. But we'll get much more into that here in a little bit. For right now, please go ahead and navigate to the week 4 roadmap page, and let's open up those slides. And once you're there, go ahead and roll into the objective slide. Our goals for the conversation today. Number one, let's get familiar with what correlation is, and let's talk about the different ways we can measure how two variables move together or move apart from each other. We're going to do some practice using SPSS to help us calculate correlations, and then we need to get into a bigger problem we run into with correlation. And that's when a lot of people assume that correlation means causation. So two things moving together must mean that one thing is causing the other thing to move with it. Well, the title of this podcast is Sharks and Ice Cream for a reason. We're going to evaluate some discussions of what are known as spurious correlations, where two things might appear to move together or be highly correlated, but really they don't have anything to do with one another. So we need to understand how movement together doesn't mean that one thing is causing the other. And this is going to be a big point in terms of our better understanding of statistics and even things like graphs and charts, right? We need to know that just because something looks a certain way doesn't mean it actually is a certain way. And then finally, we're going to have a moment in the podcast for you to think about and consider what are known as confounding variables, and how those might be affecting your research paper and research project, which I'm hoping you've already kind of started digging into and doing a little bit of investigation around. And if you haven't, that's fine, but don't put it off for too long. We are going to be definitely having those initial drafts post-midterm, so starting the writing early is never a bad idea. Okay, let's jump right in. We need to begin by backing away a little bit and talking about some key concepts. First and foremost, what is a variable? Now, I know you've encountered this probably in your textbook already, but I kind of slow roll into this conversation because, generally speaking, I want us to have a chance to go back to doing some of the things we're more familiar with, things like the mean and the median and the mode, or even thinking about graphs. That feels like a lot of review. And when we get to these conversations, there is a little bit of review, but we also need to make sure that whatever we've been taught before is in line with what we're going to be proceeding with in this class. So starting with variable, it's simply the word we use to talk about something we're interested in measuring, okay? So anything that we can measure could be a variable so long as it can take on different values. That's what vary means. It has a different or range of values that it can take on, and that's what makes it variable. We can have a different value and a different measure depending on what we're looking at, and particularly who we're looking at if we're talking about studying people. The examples I always use relate back to my previous work in criminal justice. So let's say I want to know how likely someone is to go back to prison, particularly after doing something like being in prison for a long time or engaging in certain classes in prison. Well, what I'm interested in studying is that person's recidivism, or the chances that they're going to go back to prison. Recidivism is a variable. It can range from like 0, where you never go back, to 1, where you are guaranteed to go back. That's thinking about it on a like 0% to 100% chance scale. And that's, again, a measure we can have. So what are the chances? Well, it's between 0% and 100%. So I have a range of values for recidivism between 0 and 100. But if I go for a different variable, this time looking at perhaps how long someone's been in prison, my variable can take on other values. We're talking about time in prison as my variable. So that could be anything from 0 days to, you know, years and years. If it's a life sentence, I could be looking at someone who's been in prison most of their adult life, right? This is something else I can measure in counts of days, in counts of years, right? Those are variables, and really anything we can measure is a variable we can use in our analysis of something relating to research or a research question. When we talk about variables and research, we tend to classify them into groups. So we have independent variables, or the variable that we think can explain something else. Generally, we think of this as kind of our cause, if we have a cause and effect relationship. But again, I would caution you, don't get too closely wedded to that term cause, because sometimes we think about variables the wrong way. But generally speaking, this is what that's going to refer to. An independent variable is the thing that we can change and that we think can explain something else, while our dependent variable is the thing that we're explaining. So it's the thing we think is affected by our independent variable. In the example on the previous slide, I would assume that more time in prison actually makes it more likely that you would recidivate, because I don't think that prisons really help people necessarily fix themselves, or at least that's not what the data points to. So my independent variable there would be time in prison, and my dependent variable would be recidivism. Or you can look at the example I've given on slide 4, the weather. The weather definitely affects some people's moods. It affects my moods. So how does the weather affect my mood? The weather is the independent variable, okay? My dependent variable is my mood. Or again, we can use studying and grades, thinking about how much does studying affect our grades. Well, in that scenario, studying is the independent variable and grades are the dependent variable. Whatever we're thinking of as the cause or something that creates change in another thing that we're measuring, that's our independent variable, and the thing that is changing as a result of that cause is the dependent variable. Now, related to this, we have different ways we can measure our variables. And this is going to be what we call the levels of measurement, captured on slide 5. So we have kind of 4 different classifications or 4 different levels of measurement: nominal, ordinal, interval, and ratio. And these are largely going to be getting more specific and more particular as we move up the levels from nominal to ratio. But we need to clarify, what does each level mean as far as the way we measure something? The way I describe the first 2 levels, nominal and ordinal, is to think about the first part of their names. Nominal, or nom, kind of like name. So it just has a name to describe it. This is going to be things like eye color, green, blue, brown. If we're Elizabeth Taylor, violet. If we're thinking about political affiliation, like our political party, Republican, Democratic, Libertarian, legal marijuana now in the state of Nebraska, right? Those are all different named categories, and there's no real ordering to it. There's no structure to it. They're just kind of different categories, and you can't set them up in an order, which makes it different from ordinal, where there's an order to something. So here we have named categories, and it's still an ordering, but there's a natural ordering to it. Like, think of the Olympics. Gold is the best, silver is the second best, and bronze is the third best. We know the order, but we don't have specific differences between them. We just know that gold is better than silver, it's better than bronze. But if I get a gold in swimming, it doesn't mean I've beat someone by the same amount of time as a person who wins a gold in track and field. It just means we're in order at the top versus at the bottom, or wherever else in the order we could be. Another way to think about order is class rank in a college. We have freshman, sophomore, junior, senior, super senior, graduate student, right? All of those are kind of structured and ordered. It doesn't mean that there's any kind of numbers to them. It's just named categories. But those named categories have an order, and we recognize and understand that. You could really do this for any level of school: kindergarten, first grade, second grade. We know the order, we know what comes first and what goes next, but we don't describe them using numbers, which is what sets this apart from interval and ratio. Interval and ratio variables have what is known as a proportionate interval between the variables. All that means in like math speak is that we can measure them using numbers because the differences in the numbers are set. The difference between 1 and 2 is the same as the difference between 2 and 3 or 3 and 4. Or if we use an example of a true interval type of measure, like temperature, 20 degrees to 40 degrees is the same distance as 80 degrees to 100 degrees, right? Those distances between our measures of that variable are fixed or proportionate. So again, one always increases by a certain level or a certain amount, and that amount is fixed between the levels that we measure at. You can do this with other things like age, right? Age is not an interval variable, though, because age actually has what's known as an absolute zero. And here's the defining difference between interval and ratio. An interval variable can be measured below zero. So this is why temperature is one classic example I can give that fits this. But ratio means there's a zero level that means something. So think of height. You cannot be a negative height. You can't be below zero. I've been very short my whole life and I'm certain of this thing. You can also measure things in different ways. So let's say I'm thinking about age. Age would usually be something I'd call a ratio variable because you can't be less than, you know, zero for age, at least not in terms of years. But I could think of it differently. Let's say my point of interest is age 21, when people can drink. And I could think about measuring, well, how much before 21 or how much after 21 did someone start drinking? In that case, I could go below zero because my point at which I'm measuring is from age 21 below or 21 and up. So it's a different way to think about things, but when you're trying to identify what type of level of measurement, know that if it's just got categories with names and no real order to it, it's nominal. If there's an order with the names, it's ordinal. If we use numbers to measure it, it's going to be interval if it can go below zero, and it's going to go ratio if it only goes from zero and up. And I like to use the O at the end of ratio to clarify the difference. Just kind of little different devices that I use to help me remember, and hopefully, you know, something like this works for you. Now I want you to take a step back and think about, can you come up with examples of nominal, ordinal, interval, and ratio variables that I haven't already listed in this podcast? Send me what you come up with. I'd love to see an email from you and find out how you think about these different variables and levels of measurement. And on that note, I'm actually going to segue us into another activity, but this is far more relevant to the papers that you're writing. Whatever you've decided is your possible paper topic or what you're interested in writing about, I want you to think about whether you've written that as investigation of, let's say, a relationship between two different things. Maybe foster care and mental health. Maybe where people live and how often they think they see aliens. Maybe NFL teams and whether the running game or the passing game is better for ensuring their success and winning percentages. Whatever your variables or whatever the things you're thinking about in terms of your research question, I'd like you to try to identify which one you think of as the independent variable and which one is the dependent variable. And I do want you to actually email me this. So please, when you hit this point in the podcast, take a moment to pause and send me an email, just letting me know what are your independent variables or variable, if you've just got one, which is just fine, and what's your dependent variable or variables. If you've got more than one, also just fine. But send that to me and let me know how you're thinking about them. All right, ladies and gentlemen, let's get to the meat and potatoes of today. So if the variable and, you know, discussion of levels of measurement is kind of our intro, this is the heart of today's episode. And that's, what exactly is correlation? How do we measure it? What does it mean? And what is it not? So let's start out. Slide 9. The formal definition is the interdependence of variable quantities. And that is so technical. It almost like makes me have that moment in my stomach where I'm like, no one really gets the way you've defined this. So much less formally and in my own terms, I say it's how two things that are measured move together or move apart from one another. Now, it can be more than two things. We could look at the correlation between many different things or only a few things. You have to have at least two. And so here's my visuals on slide 10. We could have two things that move very closely together, like the couple in the upper left-hand corner slow dancing. When you see people slow dance, they are moving together very closely, usually pretty slowly, and we know that we can see them both sway together. We could also see lots of variables move together. Bottom left, if you don't know the video for Gangnam Style, I really recommend you take a break and go watch it. But any choreographed dance routine usually has more than two people, and they are definitely moving together. If you've ever done cheer or dance, you know that this is like your troupe. We all move together, and there's more than two of us. Or if we're going crazy, we could be like the ballet, bottom right, where it is maybe dozens or hundreds of people moving together. Now, they're certainly not perfect. You can see some differences between the dancers, more so probably in the ballet picture than in the Gangnam Style photo. But again, they are all generally moving together. These would be probably strong correlations. Versus the top right picture, two individuals dancing together, but they're dancing swing. And swing dancing tends to allow for more individual moves from your partner, but you're still dancing together. So that's a maybe weaker correlation, but they're still moving together. So we need to know, generally speaking, if we're moving together, how does that look versus when we're not moving together? And what does it mean to say we have a positive correlation versus a negative correlation? And that takes us to slide 11. When we look at correlations in a graphing format, it's going to be like what you see on slide 7. We could see dots between the two variables where they're very close to the line, which is usually called a strong correlation. And if as one thing goes up, the other thing goes up, it's called a positive correlation, versus when one thing goes up, the other thing goes down, it's a negative correlation. We kind of talked about some examples with scatter plots, right? A positive correlation, usually the more time you study, the better you do on an exam. Or let's say the more time I work out, the more muscle I build. But we could also have negative correlations. The more I shop on Amazon, the lower my bank account balance. Or the more I work out, the more I lose weight, right? Examples of one thing going up and the other thing going up, that's a positive correlation. Whereas a negative correlation, as one thing goes up, the other thing goes down. And we can have strong correlations or we can have weak. And you can see the difference here is that the weak, the dots aren't very close to the line. We can kind of see a general pattern of the dots, but it's not nearly as close to a linear shape as the strong correlations. And then we can also have what's known as no correlation, where again, it kind of looks scattershot, like it's a shotgun blast on a sign. That's the no correlation picture on the right-hand side. When we have no correlation, there's no real pattern to the dots. It's more like kind of a circle. So when you see that, you can say, my two variables aren't related to one another or they're not moving together. They're just kind of randomly there. Now, in addition to the examples I've given now, there's examples listed on page 78 of your textbook for the types of correlations. Take a look at those and make sure that they make sense to you. And if they don't, let me know. And we can touch base and I can help to hopefully clarify a bit more. There's one important thing we need to also just go back and say a little bit more about. And that's, in order for there to be a correlation, you actually have to have a variable, meaning something that changes over like time or in different measures or across people. If you look at something that is fixed and not changing, it can't be correlated to anything. It's just kind of a flat value. So the picture you can't really see on slide 14, if you don't know the Fresh Prince of Bel-Air, well, you're probably much younger than I am, and that's fine. But in this scenario, Carlton is dancing kind of wildly, and the Fresh Prince, or Will, is standing in the back, not moving at all. Moving together means that both of them have to move. You can't be Carlton moving and Will just standing there. Both things have to change. There's another way of thinking about this on slide 15. You can't explain something that does change with something that doesn't change, or the other way around. Your age cannot explain your mood when your age doesn't change. We tend to think of age as years. So you're 15 for a whole year. Being 15 doesn't explain any mood changes or any mood swings or, you know, all of the things that people tend to associate with being an adolescent. Same for another example, crime rates. If the crime rate stays flat, but we did different things as police officers to try and affect that crime rate, well, those changes in the policing didn't do anything necessarily, right? The crime rate stayed flat. Now, these are simplifications. If we did a lot of things, if we changed a lot of things all at the same time, it's really hard to tell if there were no effects. But if it's simple and straightforward like these examples, when something doesn't change, when one variable doesn't change, we can't explain it with a variable that does change. And again, vice versa. Can you think of any other examples like this? Any time that someone tried to explain something that was different at certain points in time or different across different scenarios, but they were explaining it with something that doesn't change? I mean, truly my favorite example is when people say teenagers. Teenagers have so much that changes about them. Well, they are still teenagers. So you've got to find something else to explain it. It's not simply that they're teenagers. And if you say teenagers are always something, well, then there is no change. And teenage doesn't change. So we're not really looking at a correlation there. They're just flat. There's no variable here. We're just not looking at anything that has different values. So think about that. Try to come up with an example. And then I want you to do another activity. I want you to think about something that is correlated to your independent variable. What else would change as a result of the independent variable in your research project? Or if you don't have a clear independent and dependent variable, what's the thing you're interested in investigating or understanding? And how does that thing relate to other things? I know that's pretty vague, but so I'm interested in prison or why people go to prison or how people stay out of prison. Something else that's related to that is often poverty, right? We tend to see more likely use of prison sentences with people who have less money, probably because they didn't necessarily get great representation or simply because they were scared and they accepted a plea bargain. Or maybe it's just that individual's guilty, right? There's a lot of things that can be correlated to my prison measures. And I want to think about and consider all of those as I'm trying to understand the relationship between my variable of going to prison or coming back to prison or even staying out of prison and all the things I want to know that affect it. You know, how long was someone in prison? How many classes or programs were they involved in? Did they have visits from their family? Did they have a solid education and a good job before they went to prison or not? All things that are variables that would be helpful in understanding the relationship. Right now, let's go back to thinking about those correlations as strong, positive, weak, negative, whatever, right? Our descriptions. The way we understand those correlations and the way that we can effectively describe them using numbers is known as the correlation coefficient. So that number tells us both how strong the correlation is and whether it's a positive or negative correlation. The positive or negative is actually the value in the number. So if you have a negative number to describe a correlation, it's a negative correlation, meaning as one goes up, the other goes down. And a positive correlation means just the opposite. As one goes up, the other goes up. We can literally look at the sign, whether there's a negative sign in front of the number describing our correlation, to know the direction, positive or negative. Now, as far as strength, this is a little bit more confusing, but any correlation can be described as ranging between negative 1 all the way up to positive 1. With negative 1 being a perfect negative correlation, which is extremely strong, and positive 1 being a perfect positive correlation, which is also extremely strong. So the closer you get to those ends, to negative 1 or to 1, the stronger the relationship is. More in the middle and closer to 0 means it's weaker. So 0 means there's no correlation. That's the most weak we can ever get in terms of a correlation when there's nothing there. And generally speaking, what we say is anything above 0.5 or below negative 0.5 is going to be considered a strong correlation. Anything between, let's say, 0.5 to 0.3 or negative 0.3 to negative 0.5 is going to be a moderate correlation. And anything between, let's say, 0.3 to negative 0.3 is going to be weak unless we're really close to 0. And in that case, there is no correlation. So for me, if you're between 0.1 and negative 0.1, that's so weak, that's really not any relationship between the variables. I'm going to call that no correlation. So I have a few more levels than what you see pictured on slide 18. What's really important to understand, the closer you get to the extremes, the negative 1 or the positive 1, the stronger that correlation is. The closer you are to 0 right in the middle, the weaker that correlation is. We have some really ugly formulas for calculating the correlation coefficient on slide 19. I am not asking you to do these. I am not asking you to memorize these. I don't want you to do any of that. I just want you to see how very difficult it is to calculate these things. So thankfully, we have statistical software to do that for us. And in addition to those formulas, which are terrifying, I have a table for you on slide 20, which generally summarizes what I just said, right? The between 0 and 1, the 0, the between 0 and negative 1. But just remember that negative and positive is just one way of describing a correlation. We also need to think about the strength of it. So closer to 1, closer to negative 1, or closer to 0. All right, let's say we have this number in front of us. We have what's called the Pearson correlation coefficient. I've just called it a correlation coefficient, but the number that's a coefficient of correlation between two variables that are number measures, like two interval measures, that's called a Pearson correlation coefficient. We can actually use that to know how much is being explained in our dependent variable from our independent variable. How much movement in that dependent variable comes from the movement in our independent variable. This is called the coefficient of determination, but it's always going to be presented in academic articles or in research papers using the language of R squared. You see that pictured on slide 21 at the end of the second sentence, right? When you read this in a paper, it is listed as truly the capital R squared, the two superscript next to it. That R squared is telling us again just how much change in our dependent variable is because of change in our independent variable. And this is as close as we can get to causation, right? It's generally saying how much do they really move together, and it's the amount of explained change over total change, okay? If you need to understand how to calculate the R squared, it's just taking that Pearson coefficient and multiplying it by itself, or squaring the Pearson coefficient. That's why it's R squared. R is the Pearson coefficient, and R squared is the coefficient of determination. So at this point, let's talk about what about if we have lots of variables that we want to look at. And I've got my picture of the Gangnam Style dance and the ballerinas again, where I am looking at, okay, if we got a lot of variables and we want to think about all the ways that they line up with one another, I can understand that by using a correlation matrix, which is a table of correlations for all of the variables that we are interested in studying. Now, that correlation matrix you see pictured on slide 23, I want to walk through this pretty in depth. So first of all, you see the variables are listed both in the left-hand column going down and on the top row to the right. So hours spent studying is listed in two places. So is exam score, so is IQ score, and so are hours spent sleeping. In short, we're looking at the relationships between how much you study, what your exam scores are, what your IQ is, and how much you sleep. And this table is going to show us how much do those two things, each set of two things, correlate to one another. There's a blue line right through the middle, and all of the values on that blue line are one, because that is actually looking at the correlation between a variable and itself, which is always 100%. It's always going to match itself. We aren't interested in those. We're not figuring anything out by saying, well, something matches up to itself. Yeah, we get that. So I want you to go ahead and ignore the ones. Really, all it's saying is, yes, each variable matches itself at a rate of 100%. Great, good to know, but not really helpful with understanding correlations between different variables, which is what we're gonna step on into next. Now, I want you to focus on everything either above the blue line or below it, because that is what we're actually trying to know about and understand. Those are the correlations between all of the variables and one another. So, exam score and hours spent studying, the correlation is 0.82. And you can see that value both below the blue line and above it. And in fact, what you see is that if you fold the matrix over that blue line, the numbers are exactly the same. No matter how you look at the table, the numbers are the same in the box where those two variables meet up. You only, therefore, need to look at all of what is under the blue line or all of what is above it, and you can pretty much erase everything on the other side. You don't need to explain that because the matrix is the same both above and below. Looking at those numbers, what has the strongest correlation in this matrix? Are hours spent studying an exam score the most strongly correlated, as in the closest to a 1 or negative 1? Remembering that strength is at either end of that spectrum. What is the most powerful negative correlation we have? What's the most powerful positive one? Remembering that negative and positive is going to be determined by whether the number is negative or positive. So when we have a negative in front of the number, that's a negative correlation. Negative and positive is pretty simple. What's the weakest correlation here? As in, what's the thing closest to zero? Take some time to figure that out, and then I want you to think about how you would translate those correlations in real life. The correlation between hours spent studying and the score on your exam is 0.82. And that would translate as the number of hours spent studying increases, your exam score increases. How would you explain the other correlations using just those kinds of words, that as one goes up, the other goes down, or maybe there's no correlation? What would be the most important factors for increasing your exam score if you had to pick out, let's say, two? This is going to be similar, very much so, to a question I'm going to have for us on the midterm exam, so taking some time to practice now would be an awesome idea. All right, we know a bit about correlation, we understand a little bit about how to explain what the numbers mean, and we've even practiced with a correlation matrix. And this is all going to help us better understand, hopefully, the relationships between our variables, the measures that we're interested in understanding. But sometimes we run into a problem, which is known as a confounding variable. And this is where I get the title of today's episode. A confounding variable is a confusing one. That's what confounding means, is confusing. And what it does is it, let's say, plays a background role where maybe it's influencing both of our independent and dependent variables, or what we have listed as independent and dependent variables. And it makes it seem like there's a relationship there, when really there isn't, or maybe something else is going on. So the classic case is, as ice cream sales increase, we have more shark attacks. Our predictor, or independent variable, is ice cream sales, and our dependent variable is shark attacks. How can we possibly interpret this? Does this mean sharks have a taste for vanilla or strawberry or butter pecan ice cream? No, of course not. If you went into a room and you made that kind of argument, people would probably laugh at you a lot. I don't know how sharks taste ice cream, if they ever do. But the problem here is we have a confounding variable making it seem like there's a relationship if we don't include and understand that confounding variable. The confounding variable here is higher temperature or summertime. We have more ice cream sales in the summer, and because people are going to the beach, we also have more shark attacks in the summer. The higher temperature is really the issue that's driving both of these things, but if we don't think about it or include it or measure it, then what we're going to see is what appears to be a relationship between ice cream sales and shark attacks. So with confounding variables, as I've listed on page or slide 25, that means we want to control for them. We include them in our calculations, and that allows us to figure out how much of an effect they have. And when you actually include the confounding variable, what generally happens is the relationship that we think might be there disappears because we've actually identified what is driving the outcome or the dependent variable rather than what we may have thought it was before. So when I say you need to control for a confounding variable, it means you need to measure it and include it in your research so that when we look at the relationships between, let's say, your independent variable and your dependent variable, we know that this is playing a role in that and we can actually include it and measure it and know just how powerful this is and whether, indeed, perhaps ice cream sales do lead to shark attacks. Again, not the case, not true, but I'm using that to illustrate the point. Including those variables that could be affecting, let's say, both our independent and dependent variable gives us a much better sense of what the true relationship is between those two. The most effective way we actually have to know what the true relationship is between, let's say, just two variables that might be affected by another third thing is to calculate what is known as a partial correlation. The partial correlation is pictured on slide 26, and really what that's showing is, okay, we know that our GPA is affected by how much income our parents have, basically their relative socioeconomic status. That's what SES stands for. But it's also affected by our friends. If you tend to run around with a, you know, friend group that's kind of nerdy and focuses on school, your GPA tends to be better. But your friend network is also affected by how much money your parents make and where you tend to live. So what you see is this Venn diagram where the overlapping circles have a lot of sections that they all three kind of have some level of overlap. Well, the partial correlation says take the green circle out entirely. Let's just figure out how much parent SES affects your GPA. This means we're able to really just calculate section A, the one with the blue circle around it. That is the partial correlation, how much those two things overlap, and then eventually move together. When we do this, we can actually find out what is going on between those two variables, and we've totally excluded the effect of friends. And that's really what we want to do when we're just trying to figure out how much do two specific variables move together, keeping out anything that might affect both of them. I've given some examples starting on slide 27 and running through slide 29 of what are known as spurious relationships or spurious correlations. A spurious relationship is one that might look like it exists in the data, but we have no reason to think that these two things are related to one another. They aren't related. There's actually a whole website about spurious correlations. It's weirdly www.tylervigen.com, who I assume is the guy who's creating all of these charts. And it's just using weird data and showing, hey, there can be really high correlations between things, like up to 99%, but there's no relationship between those two things. I do like the visuals. Some of the examples are a little, let's say, crazy or extreme. So The first one, there is a 99.79% correlation, almost a perfect positive correlation between how much we spend on science, space, and technology, and suicides by hanging, strangulation, and suffocation. That, if we were to take that and say there was a relationship, we'd basically be saying spending on science causes suicide. And there's no real world in which that argument holds up very well, logically speaking. You might have individuals who do commit suicide related to the spending, but that isn't what's driving this correlation. It's quite simply, these things are moving together probably as we increase with the number of people, right? More spending on science, more people working on science, and more suicide, unfortunately, as more people are in the world. A funnier version, number of people who drown by falling into a pool and films with Nicolas Cage. However you feel about Nicolas Cage, I can promise you movies with Nicolas Cage are not making people drown. Unless the Nicolas Cage movie is on at the pool and it is so shockingly bad that you fall in and drown. There's a few Nicolas Cage films. I would say that's actually maybe something we should think about. But again, unless the movie is on at the pool, this is not what is leading to drowning. And the last example, a sad one, the divorce rate in Maine and how much people are eating margarine, okay? Again, just an example of these things may look like they move together, but that does not mean they're related. So no, eating more margarine does not mean you have a higher chance of divorce in Maine. It's just that they seem to move together. That correlation is 99.26%. And if that was a causal effect, you'd basically tell people stop eating margarine so that people stop getting divorced. Doesn't make any sense as an argument in real life. Last bits for today's conversation. The Pearson correlation, that coefficient, it's only be able to be calculated if we are using numbers, meaning we have interval or ratio measures of our variables. But we can also do correlations between nominal variables and ordinal variables and, let's say, even those other measures as numbers. They're just different types of calculations. So if I'm looking at the correlation between two nominal variables, such as, let's say, sex and which way did people vote, that's called the phi coefficient. That's what I would calculate in SPSS. If I'm looking at a correlation between a nominal variable and an ordinal variable, again, let's say sex and who ends up at the top of the class, is it mostly women, is it mostly men? That's called a rank by serial coefficient. If I want to do a correlation between a nominal variable and an interval variable, so a category and a number, it would be the point by serial coefficient. And then the ordinal with itself, let's say class rank and socioeconomic status, that's going to be the Spearman rank coefficient. And you can find all of these options using SPSS, right? When you get into SPSS and you practice calculating correlations, we have the ability to calculate a Pearson coefficient or a phi coefficient, rank by serial, point by serial, or Spearman. We just have to tell the system which one we want to calculate, and it will proceed as directed. On that note, let's go ahead and do some practice. Now, for this SPSS practice session, I've given a lot of the instructions just by saying, go do the practice problems in the book. The in-class practice in particular is really, really helpful for this. So I want you to go to your textbook into basically chapter 5 around page 91, and I want you to, if you don't have your book in front of you, there's some instructions posted on Canvas with the week 4 roadmap page. It is the in-class SPSS practice on correlation. I've created it as a separate document. So you'll see SPSS practice on correlation and partial correlation practice data set. Both of those are going to be used for this portion of the slides. And just practice. Follow the instructions there. Try to get all of the calculations figured out. And compare what you get with what's in the book. That's one of the wonderful things about the in-class practice stuff or the practice in the book. You can compare what you get versus the results that show up in the book. Okay, do practice exercise 1, exercise 2A, and then do exercise 2B. And make sure that when you do exercise 2B, What you see looks like what appears on slide 35, okay? It's a weird version of doing a correlation matrix, but we can technically do a matrix in SPSS. We just have to kind of, you know, understand which lines we're looking at. And those are the lines outlined in the orange boxes. If you get something different, let me know, and I'll be happy to correspond with you and figure out, you know, maybe where in the process we got off on the steps. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is the end of this set of slides. Please make sure you are paying attention to upcoming assignments. We have SPSS assignment number 2 on graphing due very soon. We also need to keep making progress on our papers, the research paper. We are looking at having that initial draft due around, you know, late October. That's going to be important for us. But don't lose sight of the other assignments along the way. Keep participating in the discussions as you need to. Just keep following along. Keep that calendar in mind. And let me know at any point in time if you're feeling like it's getting to be too much. Remember, it's only 5 discussions, only 5 quizzes that go into the final grade. So when things are kind of hitting the fan, so to speak, just take a breath. Figure out what you need to prioritize, and then, as always, contact me for any help. Thank you for taking the time to listen to this episode. I know it's a little longer, but it's nice to have just one episode for the entire week, and we're rolling in about a little over 45 minutes, so not crazy. Email me with any questions. You can always contact me at jemille@wsc.edu. All right, everybody, have a great rest of your day, and I hope to connect with you again soon. Thank you.